Understandably, all eyes on the special cabinet meeting today to see what government comes up with in the form of a fiscal response to COVID-19. Will it be the fire hose that we need to extinguish the fires raging across the economy, or more buckets as we've seen so far? A special cabinet meeting last Wednesday had been expected to come up with an economic recovery plan, but ended with no decisions being made. The cabinet's five clusters were asked by the president to produce a consolidated set of priorities for an economic plan to be discussed today. So let's welcome our Zoom room to find out what's on the table, what can be expected. Stuart Theobald, the chairman of Intellidex, Adrian Saville, CEO of Cannon Asset Managers, and professor of economics and finance and strategy at Gibbs, and stand-up chief economist Kevin Lings. Evening, gents. Thanks for joining us. Kevin, during times like this, we really are looking for the big guns, the bazookas, to come out. But perhaps you can just sketch the picture, the overall economic picture for us, because we're in uncharted waters here. So we can start to develop a framework of how government responds to the economic situation.
So, evening, Michael. Thanks. At the end of last year, if you remember, South Africa went into a recession. We actually last year had three quarters of negative performance, only one quarter of positive growth. So going into the start of this year, you would say the economy was incredibly weak. And I think that that is important because it's accentuated the extent of the downturn now. If I look around the world, those economies that were relatively healthy at the start of 2020, I think, are able to move through this a bit better, are able to fund themselves a bit better, are able to draw on government resources more easily. So we've been under significant strain. We know government finances have been under a huge amount of pressure. The credit ratings come down. And so going into this year, you've got to anticipate South Africa having a very significant drawdown in GDP. At this stage, I'm forecasting around minus 6% for the year as a whole. Under those conditions, you are going to see the unemployment rate move up fairly sharply. And I would argue that's both in the formal sector and in the informal sector. I think there's a real risk that businesses fail, both small and medium-sized business, perhaps slightly less risk around some of the larger business, but I think we're going to see increasing business failure. We know that a whole range of economic activity has basically come to a sudden halt, and that does a huge amount of damage to government revenue, and to the ability for businesses to stay in business. We are projecting that a revenue shortfall for this year in the order of 70 to 80 billion rand. We're thinking that government itself is obviously going to have to spend additional money, so you're looking at a budget deficit for the year as a whole that probably approaches around 10% of GDP. So there's a whole range of things that have changed very dramatically. And what that is doing is putting all facets of this economy under enormous pressure, and therefore leading to concerns about how do we support household sector, how do we keep businesses functioning, how do we keep people employed, where does government get the money from to bail this all out, should we be approaching the IMF, should the Reserve Bank be stepping in and providing more liquidity or more direct support. Whole range of questions which I don't think we've got real answers to, but there's no doubt that the longer the lockdown continues on, the more damage it does to the economy. And even if we get some sort of recovery towards the end of the year, I do think there's going to be lasting damage in terms of number of businesses still in business and obviously a residual higher level of unemployment. So a significant shock to the South African economy.
A significant shock that was echoed by Ben Biedman of Business Partners when I spoke to him last week around the role that they're playing in disbursing funds to the SME sector. And Stuart Theobald, I know in your paper that you presented to Treasury, you've put proposals for a bank guarantee scheme on the table to help alleviate some of that freezing of funds, especially when it comes to SMEs, but also to medium and some even larger businesses. Just unmute yourself before you respond there. Before we look at that, what has the SARB done so far, and has it gone far enough?
So I think we need to distinguish between SARB's measures and National Treasury or government's measures. SARB has really been focused on ensuring the financial system continues to function and the banking sector continues to function appropriately. So there have been measures to accommodate the liquidity pressure that banks are facing, as well as increased pressure on their capitalization levels. And those measures, in our reading, are really to enable banks to accommodate the stress on their existing books. They're not about expanding the capacity of banks to do new lending into the economy to try and bridge finance those businesses that are at risk that Kevin was pointing to. To get bridge financing into the economy, we need a different kind of strategy and intervention, and that's what we've been developing on our side.
And that intervention, if you look at it, is a scheme that will be crowded in by a range of funding options. So just talk me through the details of that bridge funding facility. It's something in the region of $200 billion, but effectively what we would need is a pot of around $32 billion to at least underwrite to the cost of the non-performing loans there. But you know the detail far better than I do. Just talk me through the detail of that bridge scheme.
Sure. So simply put, there are problems that the banks have that prevent them from doing large-scale lending into the economy at the moment. Number one, the risk outlook for them from a credit risk perspective is worsening dramatically. So as a result, banks are forced to provide for further bad debt than they had been, and that's a cost to the banks through their income statement. So there's a problem from a risk perspective, that the risk facing bank balance sheets has increased. Then there's also a funding problem. So banks rely on funding that they receive from multiple sources, and they use that to generate assets. And in order to manage their risk, they need to try and ensure that those are term matched to a certain degree. So you can't use short-term liabilities, short-term deposits to fund long-term assets. And that mismatch has to be managed somehow. What we're suggesting is that the Reserve Bank needs to provide the funding for the banks to use to on-lend onto businesses through a special COVID, call it a COVID emergency loan scheme. That funding, however, comes with risks. Now, the Reserve Bank can't take risk onto its own balance sheet. It has to make sure it holds collateral from banks in order to provide them with funding. So the risk has to go somewhere else. And that somewhere else, to our mind, needs to be a specific guarantee fund that's set up under the auspices of National Treasury, with a National Treasury guarantee behind it. But within that fund, you can tap multiple sources of funding, and that fund becomes your risk absorption buffer, that when loans fail to perform, when borrowers in the emergency loan scheme default, that buffer can absorb those losses rather than the banks. Now, the banks must still carry some of the risk, because we need banks to ensure that they appropriately risk manage any lending scheme. So in our view, that about 20% of loans need to remain on bank balance sheets, but you have that buffer there to absorb 80%. And that enables the banks to really go out at large scale to provide lending, bridge lending across the economy.
So that $32 billion would be the COVID-19 loan guarantee fund. How effectively would that be funded? You say a crowding in, a blended finance approach, almost like an impact investing approach to multiple sources here. Just take me through how you see that potentially being funded.
So ultimately, you want to just make sure your objective is to make that $32 billion as cheap as possible. That's your objective. Now, the cheapest form of money is grants. So money that is put into that fund in the form of donations would be your cheapest, and that's where you could start. We think there's a good case to make to the Solidarity Fund that they should support a guarantee fund, that it's a way for them to really contribute to supporting the economy through the crisis. There's also several multilateral sources of funding that includes potential grants that are being made by governments around the world to help countries like ours to fight the crisis. And then there is concessionary finance. So you start with grants and you move on to concessionary finance, which is basically accessing money that's cheaper than the normal sources of money for the government, i.e. the bond market. So any concessionary finance you can access through multilaterals, and we've seen the African Development Bank develop a scheme to support African countries. We've seen talk from the World Bank and the G20 to look at schemes that can provide discounted finance. So all of those can be accessed, and this provides a mechanism to access those in a way that's likely to appeal to certain kinds of multilaterals, whereas different alternatives wouldn't appeal. Because this is a structure that's designed specifically to bridge finance the economy and to support private sector businesses, it opens up a range of funding opportunities from multilaterals that aren't available, for instance, for central government's own funding purposes. So we think that there are different kinds of solutions that this scheme opens up for you to access cheaper finance. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, though, if you fail to raise cheaper finance, it has to be government itself that contributes the funding. But at least through a buffer fund that you are creating, you have a mechanism to go out in search of that cheaper finance. And at the moment, we're missing the mechanisms to access concessionary funding.
And it's scalable according to how much you initially raise into that fund, which is a percentage. In the paper, you say a 20% loss. So you can scale that up to the other 80%, making up the 200 billion figure that you have as a headline. Just talk to me about how you arrived at that 200 billion rand figure and the size of relief that is going to be needed and your kind of worst case scenario thinking here.
So I think this is a moving target, and that flexibility you mentioned is important. We need to be able to respond to the performance of the economy as we go. The 200 billion represents about 1.8% of GDP, and that number has been informed by schemes we've seen done around the world. So when we counted, which was about 2 weeks ago, there were 51 countries that had implemented bank guarantee schemes of one form or another. And now you range in size, but typically for a market like ours, we see about 1.8% of GDP. That's where, for instance, Brazil has gone with its scheme. And it seems a good starting point. Now, one of two things can happen. You either underperform and you lend less than 200 billion, in which case, you know, fine, provided that's a reflection of the demand in the economy. If it's not needed, then you don't use it. You might end up, however, having to lend more. And that's where the flexibility is available, in that you can increase the funding from the Reserve Bank as well as increase the guarantee fund if the performance indicates that that's warranted, that that's what you need to do. But this is going to be learning by doing. You know, as Kevin said, we're in an unprecedented environment. There are no rule books for us to really understand what kind of responses and what kind of performance those responses are going to get. But you've got to start somewhere. So these numbers are put together. We think a realistic start is going to be. And in terms of our scheme, we see an average loan size of about 100,000 Rand. So those are really a kind of small business loan size. There are 900,000 companies that file tax returns. So at that loan size, you're going to be able to reach 200,000. So you're reaching over 20% of the companies, of active companies in the country. I think that's the kind of scale you really need to prevent the large-scale business failure that is going to happen if you don't.
That Kevin was alluding to, that becomes structural inside the economy. Before we take our break, Adrian, what do you make of the proposals on the table to create this bridging loan scheme?
You know, Michael, what Stuart is proposing grabs for a critical resource in this environment, and that is liquidity. There's no shortage of liquidity in this environment. We've got global banks at zero and below. There are substantial purses of funding available. What is missing in the South African environment, I would venture, are three key components. The first is the conduit to get from that liquidity into business. The second is, you know, Stuart has made reference to 1.8% of GDP. You opened with reference to the bazookas. And, you know, globally, sort of 2% of GDP is a starting point for a proper fiscal stimulus. And South Africa simply doesn't have fiscal wiggle room. So this type of, A, the funding, and B, the conduit, steps into a yawning deficit, poor pun, but a yawning deficit. Kevin spoke about the size of the deficit that we are already sitting with. We simply don't have the wiggle room to throw, you know, more balance sheet or budget deficit at the problem. But here is a different channel, a different raft, and it would bring in not just a funding capability that is globally available, But a deficit that we haven't referenced in this conversation so far is the deficit of confidence or trust in the system. And in this type of crisis environment, what people are desperately looking for, what businesses desperately looking for, is some source of confidence, guidance that they can take from the broad system that will give them some sense of certainty or visibility.
We're talking about the fiscal response to COVID-19, which so far has been much debated, but sorely lacking. We're awaiting the outcome of a special cabinet meeting, and the likelihood of that meeting coming up with something today, probably quite slim. We'll probably, if anything, hear something tonight, maybe tomorrow morning. So in the interim, we talk about the options. And Kevin, before we went to the break, I mentioned the rumour doing the round that up to a R1 trillion fund is being considered, according to Matthew Parks, who was quoted in the Daily Maverick. How will we fund a R1 trillion fund? It sounds about the right sort of size, but that must mean things like prescribed assets and wealth taxes are back on the table.
Michael, I'm not sure how we would go about funding a R1 trillion. Obviously, a R1 trillion would start to make a meaningful difference if we directed that appropriately. And obviously, it's also important as to the speed of how you implement this. The longer you take to come up with a plan, the longer you take to implement, the more business failure you're going to have, and therefore the more structural damage you're going to do. And I would argue that already it's quite late in the process for South Africa to now only be contemplating some sort of response. A R1 trillion, no idea. My sense is that we would have to involve external funding to get close to that type of number, which means for me we would have to tap into IMF-type funding or other multilateral organizations to try and supplement what we might have in South Africa. As Adrian said earlier on, South Africa just doesn't have the fiscal space to put on the table something like a R1 trillion to try and support the economy. We've also got to be careful about this a little bit, because once you've got the virus under control, you're going to need some additional support once the economy starts to get going to provide more direction, more clarity in terms of policy initiatives, probably more money for some of the SOEs, etc. So you don't want to necessarily use all of your available resources in the shorter term. You want to find a balance between that and also trying to ultimately get investment, job creation going, etc. That also becomes quite critical. It's not just about ensuring that households and businesses survive. So a R1 trillion for me would feel a way too far relative to what we're capable of doing now. I certainly like Stuart's idea, and that together with some other household support, I think would go a long way to providing us with some safety mechanism. Remember, what you're ultimately trying to do here is you're trying to find a bridge between where we are now and where we'll end up once the virus has been controlled. And that bridge needs to be, how do we ensure the safety of households in terms of basic goods and services, and how do we ensure that as many businesses as possible survive? That's what it's really about. And the quicker we can do that, the better we can find a conduit, the better South Africa will come out of this. Once we come out of it, I think we've got a whole lot of other challenges which we're going to have to address, and I think government's going to need some finances at that point.
And one is hoping, if we look at a path through COVID-19, that it'll speed up some of those structural economic reforms that have held back growth for such a long time. But right now we're focusing on the here and now. And Stuart, I get emails on a daily basis from listeners who are sole proprietors who can't access certain schemes under TERS via the UIF. They can't comply with some of the BEE laws. There's a lot of desperation out there, individuals living from month to month who are now going to government looking for food parcels. It is really desperate, and we need to ensure that something comes quickly of this. Have you heard anything further since presenting to Treasury about government's appetite for a scheme like yours?
So we know National Treasury is looking at a bank guarantee scheme. They have confirmed that publicly. There are discussions underway. It would have to involve the Reserve Bank as well, so there would have to be joint coordination and agreement between them on how a scheme should work. So there is something in development now. Whether Cabinet is going to be in a position to confirm any details today, I would be surprised if there's too much detail, but they could at least indicate in principle whether they're going to go ahead and develop some kind of intervention along the lines of a guarantee scheme. But I think a guarantee scheme is only one part of the answer. You know, that serves to help the challenges that companies are facing to bridge themselves. But employment is the other huge challenge. And you mentioned TERS, the UIF scheme, and you know that seems to so far have been very ineffective because of the bureaucracy involved in being able to access it. You know, we need schemes that can deliver to companies immediately to ensure that they keep staff on payroll. And the only way we can imagine that's feasible is if SARS is the mechanism that you use, that either through net claims from SARS or through offsetting against other taxes owed to SARS, companies are able to cover the payroll for staff who are unable to work. And, you know, already I feel we're now in the third week of April. Companies have had a whole month, or you know, this month have not been able to function. You know, just the hospitality trade is, you know, trade and hospitality is about 14% of GDP. So, you know, it's a large part of the economy that's been shut down, and it employs many people. Now, companies in that scenario are going to be laying off staff. We haven't seen the numbers yet. But if you look at what's happening around the world, you look at the United States, which has had an unemployment rate go from practically zero to 17% in just a few weeks, which is just, you know, unprecedented. If something like that happens in South Africa, we're looking at massive, large-scale unemployment. And a bureaucratic, offering from the UIF that companies can't access is certainly not sufficient to counteract that.
Yeah, unfortunately, the wrong channel by which to be distributing anything the UIF, anyone who's ever had to access grants or benefits on maternity leave or any other individual trying to interface with UIF will attest to that. Adrian, the time issue is of the essence at this point, and one gets the sense that with the regulations increasingly at odds with each other, things like allowing the export of wine but you can't transport the product, I think public support of this lockdown is waning, it's dwindling. What is your sense of where we are, and also considering that we're due to go back to some semblance of normality following the 30th of April? Well, that's straight into a public holiday and then a long weekend, so it looks like it'll probably be extended a little bit beyond that. Can this economy afford a lockdown at this stage?
You know, Michael, I'm not sure that we could afford this coming in. Stuart and Kevin have both spoken about the importance of urgency. You know, time is of the essence here. On a vlog that I've been doing, I've made reference to data from TransUnion and Yoko, which speak about the fragility of consumers. Ruth Hall has estimated as many as 5 million traders have lost their employment. So the numbers, you know, any direction you turn, the numbers are absolutely harrowing. Speed is of the essence here. We're behind the curve in terms of implementing policy. I've used the term already. I'll use it again. The bazookas that we have to throw at this. What we require here is an extraordinary stimulus to help what was going in already very, very fragile economic circumstance and an even more fragile social fabric. So we have to work quickly. There isn't, I don't think we have the luxury of time or the privilege of time to think about, you know, weighing up all of the options. We've got to move. The moves need to be not only big, they need to be quick. We need to guard ourselves against gaming of the system and free riding. And Stuart speaks about these vulnerabilities in the paper that they've presented. I think that those are important. that we need to guard against those. And there is also a prospect here to reposition the economy structurally, which we should have been doing 5 and 10 and 15 years ago. We haven't done that, and that has exposed some of the most vulnerable parts of the economy. Social distancing is available for small parts of this economy. Probably the people, you know, listening into this interview and those of us participating in it, but for many parts of South Africa, social distancing isn't happening. Instead, it's social compression under incredibly strained circumstances.
I think that is the bottom line. Thank you very much, Adrian Saville, Stuart Theobald and Kevin Lings. That's all the time we have for today. In our attempts to flatten the curve, it does seem like we are way too far behind the economic curve. We await to see what Cabinet comes up with following that special meeting.